And thank you for being willing to participate remotely today in our oral argument. I do want to note that and ask for your patience. Sometimes there are interruptions or glitches and interruptions, that sort of thing. So if that happens, we will be patient with you and ask that you engage us the same courtesy. We'll try to do what we can to keep our interruptions to a minimum this morning. Let's call the case.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding, case A20-0880, Marching versus Zillmer.
Mr. Tom, on behalf of appellants, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Thulm, and I represent the appellant, Holly Zillmer. The district court's order granting a temporary injunction is reversible on two independent grounds. The first is jurisdictional, and the second is a misapplication of the Dahlberg factors. Speaking first to the jurisdictional issue, it's black letter law in Minnesota that injunctive relief can only issue in an already existing action. This court held in Smith v. Spitzenberger that injunctive relief is a remedy and not in itself a cause of action. A cause of action must exist before injunctive relief may be granted. And in Spitzenberger, this court was analyzing Minnesota statute 559.211, subdivision 1. That's the same statute that's at issue in this case. And that statute specifically requires, as a prerequisite to entry of any injunctive relief, whether that injunctive relief be a temporary restraining order or a temporary injunction, that an action must exist. The statute says, in an action arising under or in relation to a contract for the conveyance of real estate, injunctive relief may be granted. So here, well, the next legal principle that is significant to this jurisdictional issue is that a civil action does not commence and a court does not acquire jurisdiction until the defendant is properly served with a summons pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 3.01. So jurisdiction is not acquired until service is effectuated. And the final principle that is relevant to this jurisdictional issue is that an order entered by a court that lacks jurisdiction is void. And the Fraser v. Fraser case is especially instructive on this point. That case also involved the same statute that's at issue here, 559.211. And in that case, a court purported to enter a temporary injunction, but there was no existing action for sale of real property, which is a prerequisite to a grant of injunctive relief under 559.211. The only action that was pending was a dissolution action. And so the district court ultimately decided, because there was no action pending, there was no appropriate action commenced, that the temporary injunction was void ab initio, and the Court of Appeals agreed with that conclusion. Now here, when we look to the findings that the district court made, the district court found in the June 12, 2020 temporary injunction order that service did not become effective until the summons was delivered to Mr. Thome, to me, as Zillmer's counsel. That's a correct interpretation of Minnesota statute section 559.217, subdivision 8. The district court also found that the Marching's April 3rd affidavit of service states that the summons was mailed to Mr. Thome, but not that it was delivered to him. Thus, the April 3rd affidavit of service is not actually an affidavit of service, but merely an affidavit of mailing. The district court further found there is no evidence as to when delivery occurred. And finally, in the most important finding on this issue that the district court made, the district court found, as a result, the court cannot find that the Marchings commenced their lawsuit prior to April 7, the date of the TRO. If the court were to make such a finding, it would be unsupported by the record. For that reason, because there was no action commenced at the time the TRO issued, the TRO was void ab initio, and the district court erred by entering a temporary injunction. The district court did not have authority to enter a temporary injunction because under Minnesota Statute 559.211, Subdivision 1, the district court only has authority to enter injunctive relief prior to the effective date of termination of the contract. Here, the contract terminated on April 15, 2020, pursuant to the notice of cancellation provided by Holly Zomer, because that notice of cancellation was never effectively enjoined.
So, if I could interrupt just for a quick question. Is it Thom? Is that the right way to pronounce your name?
Yes, last name? Thom.
Okay, so Mr. Thom. So, my question is, let's say you're right, and then what happens next? I mean, is this remanded to the district court to engage in discovery on whether delivery was affected or not? I mean, what are you claiming is the proper result? And if you're correct on your jurisdictional issue with respect to the TRO.
Yes, Your Honor. The temporary injunction should be vacated. And the reason it should be vacated is because there was no authority to enter it under 559.211 because the TRO never went into effect. It was void ab initio. So that is what we're requesting. And that is the only result that is supported by the record that's on appeal today.
But then it gets remanded back to the district. I mean, what happens next if you're right? And we vacate, and what are the next steps then down in the district court?
It would be appropriate to vacate the temporary injunction, the remand for further proceedings that are consistent with that result. Now, moving to the issue of Dahlberg factors, I'd like to focus in particular on the issue of irreparable harm. There was no submission of any under oath testimony, no submission of any evidence whatsoever of irreparable harm or even harm that the marchings stand to suffer if this cancellation becomes effective. The district court did not make any finding other than the conclusory determination that the marchings stand to suffer harm. And the district court based that decision on the mere loss of a breach of contract claim. But it's clear that the loss of a breach of contract claim in and of itself does not suffice to establish irreparable harm. If it did, then that effectively reads the irreparable harm requirement out of existence, as long as you're seeking injunctive relief based on cancellation of a purchase agreement. There needs to be a showing. There needs to be some evidence in the record. There is no evidence in the record of any harm whatsoever. Moreover, cure was available to the marchings. All the marchings had to do to cure their default is provide Zomer the articles of incorporation that both Minnesota statute and the purchase agreement required the marchings to provide to Zomer prior to conveyance of the property. She asked for that document with specificity prior to the closing, and the marchings refused to provide it. Zomer provided her notice of cancellation with a right to cure. The marchings decided they did not want to cure. They refused to provide that document. But the availability of cure establishes that they did not stand to suffer irreparable harm. They had an alternative and chose not to pursue it.
So just one quick question on the required disclosures, the documents. Is there any qualification at all on your client's ability to cancel once that 10-day period to cancel after receiving those documents? Is that unqualified under the law?
It's unqualified. Yes, it's unconditional. There is a right that has no conditions attached to it based on both Minnesota statute and the purchase agreement that says within 10 days of the receipt of the last of those enumerated documents, including the articles of incorporation, the buyer has an unfettered right to cancel. And there is no dispute that the marchings never provided Ms. Zomer with the articles of incorporation. So with that, I will, unless Your Honor or any of Your Honors have any other questions, I'll end my argument there and reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. I don't see any further questions.
Thank you.
Let me just give the marshal a chance to reset the clock.
Thank you. If it may please the court, good morning. I'd like to start off with the issue of this delivery. The appellant has made much of the fact that we have not established that the delivery of the summons and complaint was received by him prior to the issuance of the TRO. I would like to point out that the delivery is presumed based upon the proper mailing of the summons and complaint and document. That's found in case law. The presumption is properly addressed information is received, is assumed. Now, it is incumbent.
But it doesn't say it's presumed within a certain number of days. Isn't that correct?
Well, it's presumed delivered, yes.
But not by before 8:45 a.m. on April 7. I mean, that you're not claiming that, are you?
No, I am not claiming that. But, Your Honor, I would say this much. You're asking for me to do the impossible. You're asking me to, first-class mail is not tracked. Therefore—
Well, wait, hold on a minute now. Yeah. It looks like your firm, in fact, sent, reserved by United States Mail with return receipt or tracking, whatever the mechanism was. So it's not impossible. It's just that you did not do it in this case. Isn't that right?
No, that is incorrect, Your Honor, because it says first-class mail, the statute, postage paid. It does not say certified mail. It says first-class mail. It does not say certified. And that's not an obligation under the statute. It says we can do it by first-class mail, which we did, or we can personally serve, which it says or.
So then you still have the problem as the plaintiff. The burden on you is to show that you served the action, correct? I mean, so you can choose not to, but that doesn't alter your burden.
Well,
are you claiming that the proper interpretation of the rules for commencement of an action in, you know, combined with this 559.211 is that there somehow or another is a statutory presumption that it's received in a timely fact, you know, that it was received. Are you claiming there's a statutory presumption by reason of the fact that 559.211 talks about first class mail?
Well, Your Honor, there isn't a statutory presumption. There is judicial notice that can be taken as to the speed of mail, which courts have taken in the past.
I'm sorry. I don't mean, and I will let you continue on with your argument. I don't mean to be jumping in here so much, but these are important facts. So did you ask the district court to take judicial notice of the general timelines for delivery of first class mail?
We didn't ask it, but the court did it on its own by stating in there, in a footnote in the order, basically saying, because both offices are in Minneapolis, that the mail more than likely was received well before the April 7th date.
But didn't the district court, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I thought the district court in fact made a finding of fact that there was nothing in the record to show that it was delivered. So is that accurate, or are you saying the court said, yes, I can presume that it was delivered by April 7th. Well,
it was a little bit inconsistent in the sense that you said, there's nothing in the record I can say delivery. And she meant that I could not present anything to say that Mr. Thome received it, that it was delivered to his office, which again, Your Honor, I cannot do that. It is impossible for me to do that. There is no way for me to do that. I would have to stake out his office and wait for the mailman to arrive to see if he was delivering it. And again, if you're going to say, well, you need the Senate by certified mail, well, that's adding to the statute. The statute says I can put it in the mail and have it delivered to him by first class mail. It doesn't say certified.
But Mr. McGee, it seems, Mr. McGee, that you're in an awkward position of being the respondent, but disputing the facts as found by the district court regarding service.
I don't believe so. I don't believe I am as to this particular point, because the district court, I think, and I, in my appellate brief, I did raise, I'm saying the court made an error here, not by not making that determination. So I did raise this issue on appeal. My concern is it, by the court reading the statute to say that it's my burden to establish it was delivered, you're making it impossible to do it by mail. You're rendering it impossible, because there's no way that a party such as me sending something in the mail to Mr. Thome can establish when it was delivered. Now, the presumption is it was delivered. Mr. Thome has to this day not said when he received it, when it arrived. So you open the door to a Pandora's box of game playing in the determination of a cancellation of a contract for deed. And remember, I have 15 days. I've got 15 days. I don't have enough time to wait till Mr. Thome gets around to telling me when it was received.
Now, you could personally serve, or you can do some kind of certified mail.
You're on, again, you guys are saying certified mail, but the statute doesn't say that.
No, I'm not saying the statute requires it. What I'm saying is, given the tight timeline, it might be prudent to choose a different form of service.
But again,
you could have.
I think it belies the statute. And you say certified, but certified does not assume what? It doesn't assume it got delivered, because the person has to sign for it. Okay, so the assumption here, and Mr. Thome in previous indications has indicated that he was not at the office. He was working remotely like many of us were doing during COVID. So the idea that somehow if I sent it by certified, it would have gotten there and he would have signed for it and everything would have been fine, I think is belied by the reality of the situation. So I think that's a misnomer there, that somehow that burden is on me to establish delivery of when it was delivered, because you're creating a scenario under the statute I couldn't comply with.
Okay, Mr. McGee, yeah. On what authority do you say that the burden is not on a plaintiff in a civil action to demonstrate that they have completed, that they have undertaken the steps necessary to commence an action?
It's the
presumption. On what authority? I mean, authority. I don't want argument. I want a case or some other authority on which we can rely to go along with your position.
Okay. The cases are cited in the material which establish the presumption that if I put it in the mail, it has been delivered. Okay. Now you're asking me about timing. Okay. I have no control over the timing. Okay. I can't establish when it reached Mr. Thome's office. You're asking me to do the impossible, and the statute should not be interpreted to mandate that I do the impossible. And plus, I think you open the door to gamesmanship, as has occurred here, that say, I'm not going to tell you when I received it, because you're going to have to prove something that is impossible for you to prove, is when the mailman dropped it off in my office. And I think that's really the Pandora's box you're opening, especially in contract for deed cases, where what other options do we have? What other options? I couldn't personally serve Mr. Thome. He wasn't in his office. He put on the cancellation that I could serve him at his address, his office address, which I did.
Well, you say, when you say you don't have any other options, there is, of course, still the extra, going the extra mile of certified mail.
Again, you when I put it in the mail, as the statute says, okay, how do I know he didn't get it?
No, I understand that. I'm just saying, when you say you have no other options in order to avoid having to prove a circumstance you lack the evidence to prove, yeah. That would be an option. I'm not saying it's required by law. I'm just saying that certainly.
Yeah, I think if the statute says first class mail certified return receipt, then we would be obligated to do it. But it doesn't say that.
No, I'm not talking about an obligation. I'm responding to your statement that you had, there was no opportunity for you to create facts that you could later prove.
So, but I think by the logic is, if I follow the statute and I do what it says, somehow you're saying that, oh, there's this other option you could have picked, despite the fact that it's not in the statute. Oh, you could have done that.
No, I'm just responding to your statement. I'm not saying that the statute requires it. You said there was no way that you could prove other than to rely upon Mr. Thome, and you're subject to gamesmanship. I was suggesting that there is an alternative that would both be within the statute, but not a requirement in your power.
Yeah, I guess I belabored this point. I believe this is a fundamental mistake fundamentally as to the statute. But putting that aside, I'd like to transition here. Let's assume that as the question seemed to propose, that somehow that service was not accomplished on Mr. Thome. The question becomes, does the judge, Judge Freeman, does she have the authority to issue a TRO? And clearly she did.
By the way, just to quickly interject, I wasn't hoping that my question would make any such suggestion. I was just responding with a hypothetical to your statement of impossibility. Yes.
So we transition to the statute, which I think it says that an action, but also the order references, or the statute references Rule 65, which indicates obviously that the TROs can be issued without an action pending, and the authority and the court, Judge Freeman latched onto that and said, basically, regardless of the issue of service, I can issue a TRO based upon the circumstances of this case, and I have that authority. And so I think even if we assume for sake of discussion that service wasn't accomplished, it's clear that I think that the judge did have authority to issue the TRO based on the circumstances and based on Rule 65, which allows a court to issue it without notice and without an action being pending here. I would like to just briefly touch on the Dahlberg. Counsel misstated the record. There is no evidence, or at least there's been no determination that in fact Ms. Zillmer did not receive the Articles of Incorporation. She signed a document indicating that she did receive the Articles of Incorporation. Counsel says, well, she asked for them again. You know, you should have cured this by providing it. If we would have provided them, would have been in essence an admission that they were not provided, and they would have exercised the 10-day right of rescission and rescinded the—
Mr. McGee, if I can interject for a minute. Stepping back and looking at this as a— apart from these specific facts, if there's a cure period, what, if any, authority is there to suggest that there is irreparable harm if some action to cure is not taken? Does the opportunity to take action to cure something mean that there is, as a matter of as an automatic matter, that there's no irreparable harm?
Well, number one, there was nothing to cure, okay? She was provided the documents. She acknowledged that receiving the documents. There is nothing to cure. So when you say provide to cure, there was nothing to cure.
Can I ask you just one quick question?
Yeah.
Is there anything in the record showing the packet of documents that— and I should have looked, and I'm remiss, but I will after the argument.
I don't believe there's anything in the record regarding a packet of documents
that were actually provided. I understand your argument about the fact that she signed saying I've received everything, and I understand that argument.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, what she indicates, she received everything. So the idea that I had something or my client had something to cure, I think is belied by that waiver or that statement that she received everything. But going to your point, if we did in fact provide documents to them, the 10-day right of rescission would have run, and they would have, you know, utilized that to cancel or rescind the contract, which in essence is—
Mr. McKee, I'm going to interrupt again because I'm not satisfied with the answer to the question I had asked earlier.
Yes.
Just stepping away from the facts, if there's a cure period, is it ever the case that there's irreparable harm?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. When you say cure period, you know, in this case, number one is you're assuming there needed to be cured. Second is that the cancellation itself defined what needed to be cured, which it didn't. And so therefore, I don't think in this situation you can say, oh, you know, you should have just done what they've asked, because by doing that, you in essence are creating a scenario where the contract is going to be canceled by that term.
I guess to be more precise, does the plaintiff have an option to forego whatever action it would be necessary to cure and seek a TRO and look at irreparable harm, or is that option off the table as Mr. Thom's interpretation would suggest?
Well, I mean, it's clear. And again, it's the irreparable harm here is not just loss of the ability to pursue under the purchase agreement. But remember, when you cancel a purchase agreement, all your rights on there, including the right of specific performance, is totally vacated. And so you have no remedy at that point in time. You're remedy-less at that juncture. And so that's what the trial court says, that there is irreparable harm. When counsel indicates that all he had to do is provide the articles, his cancellation didn't provide that. His cancellation said, we didn't receive documents as required by the statute, never defined what those documents were. So, and again, the issue of irreparable harm here goes back to the facts here, is that the Marchings had a contract and Ms. Zillmer used as a pretext this issue of the Articles of Incorporation as a basis to try to get out from underneath the contract that she was duly bound to do so, perform. And so there is facts in the record. Judge Freeman weighed those facts, and her determination as to the Dahlberg methods is clearly not erroneous by any stretch of the imagination.
All right. Thank you very much.
See, I'm out of time. So,
Mr. Thom, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in the first place, the biggest problem with the service issue here was there was just a deficient and incorrect affidavit of service that was submitted. The affidavit of service, which was actually an affidavit of mailing, as the district court found, simply stated that service was effected on April 3rd, but it wasn't. It's not effected until delivery. And so that affidavit of service was simply incorrect. And Mr. McGee was asked, are there alternatives? Could you have done this by certified mail? Not only could he have, that's what he did do. That's what he did do after the TRO went into effect. Days later, when they attempted service, they sent certified mail. So that was certainly an option that Mr. McGee had available to him. And Mr. McGee accuses me of playing games. I'm playing no games here. The first that I learned of the temporary restraining order was when Mr. McGee's office emailed that document to me after it had issued from the district court. That was the first I learned of the litigation at all and the temporary restraining order request or the temporary restraining order. Now, Your Honor asked questions about if cure is available. Is there case law that says that means there can be no irreparable harm? Yes, there is case law on that point. It's Bell v. Olson from this court in 1988, where a party sought an injunction under 559.211, and the court held that the party did not stand to suffer irreparable harm absent an injunction because that party had the opportunity and the apparent ability to cure the default. And that's exactly what the Marchings had available here. They could have provided her the Articles of Incorporation. They knew the document had not been provided. Zillmer had specifically requested it of them prior to closing. And when you ask about what's in the record on whether it had actually been provided, there is under oath testimony from Ms. Zillmer, and she attaches exhibits where she's saying, I have not received this document. And I received this document from the Marchings. No response, no compliance. So with that, unless Your Honors have any other questions, I will respectfully ask that the temporary restraining order be vacated. Thank you.
Could you, if you still have a little bit of time, could you briefly respond to what Mr. McGee was saying, the kind of the bind that he felt his client was in upon the choice between trying to cure and what that might trigger? If they did provide the Articles of Incorporation, what does that due to the contract?
So under the purchase agreement, as well as Minnesota statute, a buyer who is entering into a transaction that involves a homeowners association, as this transaction does, has an unequivocal right to cancel within 10 days of receiving the last of the documents that are enumerated in the purchase agreement and under Minnesota law. And included in those, among those documents, is the homeowners association document. Marching's never had a choice but to provide that document to my client, and provision of that document does trigger a 10-day cancellation period. That's what's provided for by both the legislature and by the parties to their contract in this specific case. So unless there are further questions, I will rest my argument there.
Well, thank you both, and thank you for your briefs and your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.